You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our speaker is Kevin Anderson at the London School of Economics, talking about the brutal logic of climate change. Stay tuned for our after-speech discussion with Bill Calvin.
Difficult to envisage anything other than the planned economic recession from being compatible with stabilisation at or below 650, in other words, at or below 4 degrees C. So even for 4 degrees C, you need to have rapid reductions in emissions now. And that's the latest one, just more recent paper, saying if we went to the peaking dates that everyone else used in 2015, 2016, then you'd have the prolonged austerity for Annex 1 countries. Well, maybe we're going to that anyway. And you'd have a rapid transition away from the development patterns for non-Annex 1 countries. These are radical differences to the other. So why is it they're so different? Why, from the same science, you know, the Avoid Project, a lot of people in the Hadley Centre, we're using their Hadley Centre data. So why is it that these are so different? Well, to summarise that part, firstly, the recent historical emissions in all the models we can look at there, all those ones I referred to then, they are somewhere between mistaken and massaged, and you can take your own view as to how you want to view that. You know, 1 to 2% per annum growth rate is not responsible when we're growing at 3, 4, 5 or 6%, and they should actually be factored into the models. They have a short term is downplayed for the next few years. They assume it's going to remain very low. They have a Machiavellian or dangerously misleading peak date, 2015. I mean, something back in 2005, the peak date. The reductions are universally dictated by economists. They, you know, they keep referring to the word as feasible. The first Committee on Climate Change report has the word feasible 12 times in the report. Yeah. And they both mean feasible, economically feasible. It won't worry the economists too much. The rest of it, the science stuff, is completely infeasible. Emissions floors are poorly accounted for, the food part, but that's not the fault. You know, that's because it's a relatively new area. It's quite difficult to deal with. So there's no one to blame for that. I mean, this is just the nature of how we learn. Geoengineering is what that's sucking the CO2 out of the air or shoving sulfates in the atmosphere and reflecting sunlight or some other Dr. Strangelove approach. The geoengineering approaches are widespread in the low-carbon scenarios. We can find virtually no low-carbon scenarios that do not include large parts of geoengineering in there, things we have never been able to do before. Now, that's not to say we couldn't do them, but they're just embedded in the models as if, of course, we can do it. Now, if the odd one had it in, fine, but they've all got it in, pretty much. And the Annex 1, non-Annex 1 emissions split is neglected or hidden. It occurred in 2006. The Annex 1 emissions became lower than the non-Annex 1 emissions for CO2 in 2006. There are major models out there that produced after 2006, some of the ones that report to the US Climate Change Science Programme, that said that the emissions would switch between the two, somewhere between 2019, I think it was, and 2023. It occurred in 2006. So why is it that we're reliving history? It's a bit like 1984. You just write the history to make it convenient. And there's great assumptions about technologies, these whiz-bang technologies. And the politicians are very well-versed in Latin, know nothing about it. And us engineers are saying we can do all sorts of things. It gives us some sort of budget to play with. In reality, big technologies are not going to solve the problem for you. We cannot deliver them fast enough. We're not going to be building 30 nuclear power stations in the UK by 2020. We might have one. But we're not going to go anywhere near the sort of styles of change that we need. And we have a magician's view of time. We think that the bull can go into the China shop and then come back out. And, you know, and the crop can go back together. There's no assumption, no understanding of entropy in the way we look at these sets of issues. And we think things are linear. There's no threshold issues. That's why we have different conclusions. This is all very despairing, depressing news. So a lot of the work that I and my colleagues have done has actually been looking, what can you do? And that's sort of been pushed aside more recently as we sort of go through these sort of talks of doom and gloom. So we're trying to go back now to look at some of the work and say, what can we do, and revisit it. But this is just some potted ideas of what you might consider doing and could at least point us in the sort of right direction. Have we got the agency? Have we got the facility for us to change what's going on in a level that's broader than keeping with 2 degrees C or something near it? We need about 10% reduction in emissions year on year. That's a sort of global level. We really could do with a bit above that for the Annex 1 countries, the wealthy part. But that's a 40% reduction in emissions by 2015 in the next 4 years, not 3 years. 70% reduction by 2020, 70% reduction of emissions. And particularly for the Annex 1 countries, no emissions basically by 2030, from energy at least, if not from other sectors. So that's the sort of challenge we're trying to meet, not the sort of numbers you normally hear. And remember, a lot of the numbers you hear from the EU are premised on the idea we can buy out the emissions, effectively offset them by getting the Ghanaians to make the changes for us, or the Nigerians. What you see, other numbers for the UK and the EU, bear in mind when you look at those, a lot of that is purchased, the reductions from elsewhere. Now, they're impossible, so we get told. Well, we're in 2011, we're, the boat's gone. You know, we're starting the dockside, looking at the thing disappearing over the horizon. So, yeah, they are impossible, so we keep getting told. But then living at 4 degrees C is also impossible. So the future is impossible. As academics, that's great, because we get a blank sheet of paper and say, what on earth are we going to do about this then? We haven't got a clue. And that's true, we have no precedence for understanding this world. The first bit of agency is equity. I try to do my work very carefully, very neutrally, but I'm a fully paid-up, lefty, liberal, woolly-type, westerner. So I was worried about it at first. Is this me just trying to move things in my direction? But actually, when you play with the numbers, I don't think it is. There's little chance of changing policies that are going to affect 6.85 billion people's emissions. It's near 7, it's pretty much on 7 billion now, isn't it? What can we do about the people who are emitting? Well, Vilfredo Pareto, well-known in the LSE, I would think, good old Italian economist. But as an engineer, we used to call this rule of thumb before I knew it was an Italian's idea. The 80-20 rule. 80% of something is related to 20% of those involved. And it holds for lots of things in life. It's just a rule of thumb. But actually, when you start looking at emissions, it works really well. If you muck around with emissions data, 80% of the emissions come from about 20% of the population. That's not a great surprise, to be honest. And in fact, I think it may be higher than that ratio. Can you run that three times? Is that reasonable? Again, in our provisional work on this, it doesn't seem unreasonable to run that idea three times. So you then look at within the 20%, do the 80-20 again, and then do it again. And then you get 50% of the world's emissions come from 1% of the population. It's a much smaller group of people you've got to deal with, if you look at it like that. And that, again, seems to hold quite well. Now, it might be 40% and 3%. Or it might be 60% and 2%. But it gives you an idea that emissions come from a very small group of people. And every time we shave, if you're a bloke, you see one of the people in the mirror. So we know who they are. So who's in the 1%? Well, every climate scientist. I can't think of any I've come across that are not there. Any journalist, pontificator or denialist as they leap around the world on their planes. Any academic in the OECD, and probably any academic pretty much around the world, will put themselves in that 1% or somewhere approaching it. Anyone who gets in the plane once a year? Anyone been in the plane in the last year? No one. It's an amazing audience. Anyone been in the plane last year? Very, very few people been on planes. I think there may be people not being fully honest here. And for the UK, anyone earning over 30k, and if you're on £30,000 a year, and if you're an academic, if you're doing your PhD, your MSc, you're aiming to earn over £30,000 a year, that's your aspiration. We're all aspiring to get in the 1% as fast as we possibly can. It's all quite worrying, isn't it? Everything is pointing in the wrong direction here. We know where the 1% is, and it's us. Are we, principally in the Annex 1 countries, but also probably 300 million very wealthy Chinese and a whole lot of wealthy Indians as well, and other wealthy people in other poor parts of the world, the wealthy ones in the world, are we prepared to have, either voluntarily or enforce on us, substantial personal sacrifices in terms of how we live our lives in the short term? Are we prepared to have those things? Are we prepared to walk home tonight, not fly back to see our families, not to go on holiday in the traditional ways of leaping on planes, cut back on washing machines and all the other things that we do, not wash our clothes too often, not shower every day, we should shower once a week years ago. Are we prepared to do those things? And I think the answer is probably in now, but without the W. So we're not, are we? So what we're saying is we're prepared to live with 4°C, and we don't really care if the poor people in the world really suffer from that. That's why it's a development issue. We all laugh at these sorts of things, but the repercussions for this are people will die. Large numbers of poor people around the globe will die because we've said no. I do get quite passionate about it, and I get criticised for that, but the numbers say this, and we should be honest about it. We do not care about other cultures a long way away from us, because we don't. We can pretend we do. We can send a bit of aid occasionally and pop over there and try and do something, but we don't really care. So I think there's a real worry that we've not actually started to address the implications of what it is we're doing in our lives. And equity, thinking about what the 1% needs to do, could actually mean that we have some purchase on who we have to get to change. And if we could do that, we recognise it's us, it's a small number of people that have to make changes to their lives. And the argument that's usually made about this is that, well, all the Chinese want to have fridges as well. Well, just do the maths on that. Take the mode emitter in China, have them grow at 10% per annum per year in their emissions, and then look when the emissions matter, and they don't. Not for a long time into the future, by which time, if you haven't got decarbonised power systems, it's too late anyway. So the mode emitters buying fridges do not matter. It only really matters about the wealthy. Us. So the next bit is technical efficiency. Is there a message of hope in technical efficiency? Well, let's have a look at the electrical system. These are compact fluorescent light bulbs here, I think most of them. So these are already moving in the right direction. They won't be. There were some halogen things. So if you want some light, so you need some electricity. You need a transmission and distribution network. You need a power station. You need some Venezuelans to rip up their countryside and have an open cast pit for us and a port and some train lines and ferry, actually, ships bringing the coal over. To put some numbers on that, if you want 10 units of useful light, then you have to put in something like 50 units of energy into that system. You can do this with fridges and for cars and other things as well. You're going to lose something like 8%, maybe 9% in your transmission and distribution network, most of it in the distribution, the low voltage network around your city. That's where most of the losses are. Your power stations are rubbish. Our power stations are rubbish. They're constrained, again, by thermodynamics. They're going to be somewhere between 35 and 55% efficient. And you can't really get them much higher than 55%. and you've got to get the stuff out of the ground. So someone's got to dig the stuff out of the ground for you. So you start to think, well, why are we spending so much time worrying about this? Turn the lights off when you leave a room, and you save a huge amount. Change the number of light bulbs you have, or how many, type of light fittings you have, the wattage of the light bulbs, and you save a huge amount here. One unit saved there is 13 here. Yet we don't think about this. This is the demand side. It's what we do day in, day out has a dramatic change on the system. And we can do that really quickly. Most things, fridges, 8 years from now, pretty much all the fridges will be replaced. Cars is the same. One thing after another on the demand side, within 8 year cycles, if not shorter for things like toasters, you swap out the more efficient ones, which have almost no price premium anyway, and you dramatically reduce your emissions. There is huge scope there if the policymakers get off their backsides and actually start to show some leadership. So the demand opportunities dwarf the supply opportunities. And this one here is for cars. Now, there's no rebound here. In other words, if you make cars more efficient, the distance you travel for a certain amount of money gets cheaper, and you therefore drive further. So I'm not including any rebound here. And actually, in Annex 1 countries, that's not uncommon. We're not seeing big increases in the driving of the UK, vehicle kilometres, UK, Germany, France as well, I think.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are listening to one of Britain's top climate scientists, Kevin Anderson, in his speech, Beyond Dangerous Climate Change, Emission Scenarios for a New World.
So in the UK, our emissions, if you go out and buy a car now from the forecourt, it's going to be about 150 grams. That's the new cars that you would buy on average, grams of carbon per kilometre. The average car driving past here will be about 175 grams, probably slightly lower because London is a bit wealthier, but something like that, 175 grams of carbon. The EU, radical EU, is coming up with an idea by 2015, it's going to have 130 grams. It's got to be the fleet mean. But if you're Beckham, if you're wealthy, if you're us, we can still drive four-wheel drives. You don't have to worry about it. We can still have them because we're about to pay for having a more polluting car, and someone else will have to compensate for that elsewhere. So that's 130 grams. But in 2008, this slide was in 2010, but actually in 2008, BMW produced a 3 Series, 160 horsepower, fast. One of my neighbours has one of these. It's the sort of things that certain types of blokes like, anyway. Now, it's a fast-looking car. It zooms along the roads really quickly, except it's normally stuck in a queue with all the other cars. But anyway, they think it's just something about their status and their prowess in various departments. But that's the sort of thing that a lot of people like. Yeah, look at that, 109 grams. They can have all their status, 109 grams. Now, my friend's got one of these. I said, what happens when you drive it fast? There's other terms he uses, but anyway, drive it fast. And he says he drops about 50-odd miles per gallon. Now, that's phenomenally good for a car going really quick around the Peak District, which is where I live. But most of the time, he's getting 70-odd miles to the gallon out of a BMW. If you go to Skodas, in 2008, again, Skoda VW, 85 to 99 grams. The new Kia is £9,500, 7-year warranty on it, and it currently may look, Clarkson may not like it, but then I don't like Clarkson. It comes in at probably something like 80 to 85 grams of carbon per kilometre. These cars are available now. They're not hybrids. These are normal internal combustion engine cars. Diesel's pretty much all of these, with some slight stop-start technology and some common rail high-pressure engines. But nothing fancy in them. We can do this now, no price premium. The A2 from Audi came out in 1998, was 75 grams per kilometre. In 8 years, 90% of the kilometres travelled by cars will be travelled by cars that are under 8 years old. So in the next 8 years, you can dramatically change that. Now, you could, of course, adjust that with a scrappage scheme or some other scheme. So you could make that faster if you wanted to, if the policies want to do it. So if, in fact, you just had a policy that said, next year, the only cars you can sell in the UK are 110 grams per kilometre, and we're going to improve that at 3 to 5% per annum, which is sort of normal improvement rate, then you'd see 50% reduction in CO2 emissions from the UK's car fleet by 2020. That's no new technologies, no hybrids, no electricity, just bog-standard diesel cars with all the sorts of stuff you see in most cars today. If you then say, let's reverse the occupancy trend, there's about 1.3 people per car at the moment. It used to be about 1.5, 10, I think, slightly, maybe nearer 15 years ago now. Then you can see about 70% reduction by 2020 if you find some policies to get slightly reverse the occupancy. Remember, most cars have got 4 or 5 seats in them. They just wander around with 1.3 people in them. So 70% reduction, that goes back to the figure before. That's the sort of number we're talking about, 70%. There's a lot we can do with existing technology and with changing the sorts of ways we live our lives, but not radically changing them. Now, we'll have to change some of the other parts of our lives very significantly. I mentioned earlier things like showering. I increasingly get annoyed with this because I know people that shower twice a day where I work. You work on climate change and you shower twice a day. When I was a kid, we had a bath once a week and I shared the water. My mum got in it, then me, then my brother, in the same water. And we didn't run around and think, well, everyone stinks. There are people showering every day, now twice a day, and they're power showers people get into. Absolutely ridiculous. It means you're washing your clothes a lot more often. We're embedding a whole set of completely obscure behaviours and practices, and we're normalising them. You laugh at someone if you think, oh, you only wash twice a week. You stink. You don't stink of perfume, maybe. So there's a lot that can be done. So to conclude, if you take fairly conservative assumptions, if you assume the science is broadly right, and I think science is broadly right on this, if you assume the non-AIDS 1 countries, India, China, and the poor parts of the world, can peak by 2025 to 2030, that is challenging, but I think doable. If there are rapid rates in reductions of emissions from deforestation, which I've not talked about, but we've done quite a bit, well, done some work on that. There are moves in that direction, but it's much higher than people traditionally have thought. If you could halve food emissions from where they are today, and remember they're going completely the opposite way, everyone's trying to eat more meat and get more like us in the West. If there are no tipping points, discontinuities out there, that mean that the planet, if you like, takes over. And if the economists are right and you can have we can get a 3.5%, maybe 4% per annum reduction rate in emissions after a peak, 2°C stabilisation is virtually impossible. So we can't do it, even if we follow all of those sets of assumptions. And 4°C looks likely, and it could be much earlier than people thought. It's not looking at like the 2100 time scale. The more bitches you do on climate, the more it appears that these things tend to be turning out to be earlier. That, which actually in some respects is quite good from a political perspective, because that brings us to the time frames we can all start to recognise. Most of you will be here. Some of you, I know, have hair like my colour, and you're unlikely to be here in 2050. Yeah, unless there's a bit of stem cell improvement. But many of you here will be here in 2050, and you'll certainly be here in 2040 and 2030. So these are time frames that we're all going to be living through, and our kids will be living through. And if we're heading towards 4°C, the implications for the wealthy parts of the world, we're not going to be insulated from it. There'll be all sorts of repercussions of that sort of world. So where does this leave us? Well, some time ago, my colleague Alice said, and we were told at the time we couldn't say this, it came out in the press the following year, we should mitigate for 2°C, reduce emissions aiming at 2, and plan for a 4°C rise. So the adaptation community, the development community, should think about much higher temperatures, because we're going to fail at 2. But she pointed out recently that actually we've got the worst of all worlds. What we're doing is we're mitigating for 4°C, we're reducing emissions for a much higher temperature, but we're only planning for 2. So most of the people I know working on development issues are not thinking about dramatic changes to the places that they are involved with. And the implications for that are severe. You might put in a sewage system into a new town or city, or slightly older town or city, but if that sewage system becomes inundated with seawater in 2030, 2040, 2050, you'd have much higher risks of all the diseases that get associated with that, cholera, typhoid, and so forth. So you've got a whole set of things that we're putting in train here that maybe give you good, quick returns, but really bad for the poorer parts of the world later on. So it's maladaptation. We're heading for the worst of all worlds. This is not meant to be overly depressing. It's not meant to be a message of futility. There are things that we can do. It's supposed to be a wake-up call. Take off the rose-tinted spectacles that we've been wearing for the last 20 years and just start to look at what's out there. Do a bare assessment of where we are today. And if we know where we are today, we can then start to think, what do we need to do? If we don't know where we are today, if we pretend we're not where we are today, then we don't do anything of any use at all. Message of hope here. This is from Robert Ungar. I use this quote repeatedly. At every level, the obstacle to transforming the world is that we lack the clarity and we lack the imagination to conceive that it could be different. Clarity and imagination. What is the job of universities, other than it appears to me doing lots of admin? But other than the admin, it is about clarity and imagination. It's about research. It's about thinking the unthinkable. It's about thinking differently. And that's our job, to think differently. So I'll just finish off with this one. This was me up until 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago now. I've now moved. And I lived on my own in a stone terrace in the Peak District. It was a three-bedroom, it wasn't a massive terrace, it was a nice terrace, three-bedroom house. I now live in a two-bedroom flat. Don't feel sorry for me, it's a very nice flat, but I've deliberately downsized. But it's still a lovely flat, and if I lived in Bangladesh, I'd have about 30 other people living in there with me. So I'm still living a completely profligate lifestyle. People heat their gardens in the UK, patio heaters. They sit outside pubs in November having a pint underneath a heater. Absolute madness when we're trying to deal with climate change. But the halogen light bulbs in kitchens, there's one bulb. They're worse than Edison light bulbs from well over 100 years ago. You never have one, you have a whole set of the damn things. They're a disaster for emissions. We put 2 tons of four-wheel drive car to transport 70 kilograms of useless flesh 3 miles to pick up a newspaper. And what on earth are we playing at? And then we drive our kids to school because they might be hit by one of those people on the way. We think it's reasonable for business tycoons to have private jets. Private jets? What sort of world are we living in? Academics flying to climate change conferences. It's funny, but remember what we're talking about. It's quite sad, isn't it? As well, really, what we're doing. But it's okay, because we've got musicians coming the other way, going to climate change concerts to sing about, So we've got numerous of those sort of things going on. Madonna's climate carbon footprint is probably about as low as Al Gore's. We celebrate the excesses of celebrities. Just go to the station and look at the magazines in the station. I spend a lot of my time in train stations. Just look at the magazines, not the top ones, the ones below those. And it's just full of how can we consume more, consuming more monthly, you know, excess consumption weekly. There's nothing in there about people trying to live frugal lifestyles. And if they are, they'll be completely laughed by everyone else. What eccentric nutter. Yeah. Most of the people around the globe, of course, are living low emission, low consumption lifestyles. Most of that 6.7 billion people are doing that. And we're laughing at them. Whilst we purchase these ridiculous magazines that all aspire to live these stupid lives, watching ridiculous programs that celebrate these sort of excesses. And when we're trying to deal with climate change, that's fine if we dealt with all these issues, then we can live that sort of lifestyle. It's a hedonistic lifestyle. That's fine if you deal with the problems. These problems are absolutely severe, and that we're actually holding those two together. Severe problems with this hedonistic consumption attitude. We think we've got a right to fly and drive when and wherever we want. Year-round strawberries, hen parties in Prague, birthdays in Barcelona. Someone I knew recently said that he's having a stag do in Hawaii. Hawaii. Him and his mates are going to Hawaii for a week for a stag do. You used to go down the pub with your friends. I've got friends who got married, and I do a lot of rock climbing. We'd go out for a walk in the hills. Yeah. Hawaii. Double door refrigerators and home cinemas. Second home, I won't ask anyone who's got a second home here. Second homes in a world with 7 billion people. Second homes, 2 cars, 3 TVs, and 9 billion people moving up towards that level on the planet. And we think that technology can solve the problem for us. It's time we sort of got real and start to look at the scale of the challenge that we've set ourselves. It's no one else's fault, it's our fault. But set ourselves and start to be a bit more honest about it. And then we might start to come up with some more innovative solutions about making the impossible future possible. Right, thanks very much. They've got the political scientists saying we can't tell the chief scientists. The chief scientists are saying we can't tell the ministers. And the ministers are saying we can't bring this up in international negotiations. We're all trying to spin the message to make it acceptable to the next tier up. But whilst I'm doing this, there are a whole load of people like me, academics, giving much more rosy views of this. And if you sit with them over a pint, they'll say, well, I know it's not true.
That was Dr. Kevin Anderson, former director of the Tyndall Centre in the UK and now professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester. This speech is courtesy of the London School of Economics lecture series, and it was recorded October 21st, 2011. Find all the links you need in my blog at ecoshock.info. From the University of Washington in Seattle, our guest is William H. Calvin. He is a theoretical neurobiologist and author of a dozen books, including A Brain for All Seasons, Human Evolution, and Abrupt Climate Change. Professor Calvin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
The papers by Kevin Anderson, formerly with the Tyndall Centre in the UK, and I'm thinking of his paper, for example, Beyond Dangerous Climate Change, Emission Scenarios for a New World, and he calls that the brutal logic of climate change. His speech is hair-raising, and he's suggesting that we're in such serious trouble because governments are unwilling to hear what is being said by the scientists. And that at this point, we're headed to 4 degrees at least, and maybe 6 degrees. And he's been polling climate scientists informally at meetings, saying, what do you think? And about 77% say that we're not going to make it. And I'm just wondering what your reaction to that is.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But what everybody's doing is they're thinking end of the century, when there is sort of the time frame they're thinking in terms of. And I'm in the position of saying that because of abrupt climate changes superimposed on a gradual warming trend, we could be in deep trouble long before the end of the century. And deep trouble being if you had major crop failures around the world to the point that you couldn't feed the big cities and people in the big cities would flee, you'd have a general population downsizing, that is to say, all the four horsemen of the apocalypse, in effect. You would have famine, you'd have war, you'd have genocides, and you'd have a lot of public health problems from all those people on the move. And, there would just be a really substantial loss of human population and certainly be a mass extinction of species as well.
I'm worried that we may hold it together somewhat in the Western countries. And it's already started where you watch on television millions of people on the move, as we've seen from Somalia, for example, into Kenya. They're forming new cities there. And we'll begin to take it for granted. We won't send aid. We'll say, oh, well, what can you do? So you have the spectacle of watching millions of people die on high-definition television.
Right.
Very frightening prospect for what that means to be human.
Yeah, because well, his life is cheap kinds of things in people's minds. And, you know, that's a bad prescription all by itself. But what I'm saying is that if you, unless you set out to repair the climate rather than just keep us from making it worse quite so fast, you've really got to set out to do things that will enable you to counter all of the continuing emissions that you're going to get, even if you could get the developed countries to stop. You wouldn't do anything in the countries that have their own coal and oil and want to modernize. They need electricity, and so they'll burn their own fossil fuels to get it. I think we have to plan to take an equivalent amount of CO2 out of the air on a continuing basis. It's the only way that we're possibly going to counter the worldwide emissions trends.
Well, Professor Calvin, we're all looking for reasons to hope, and one of the things that struck me about your work was you said that the human brain was big enough over 100,000 years ago, and yet about 50,000 years ago, we seemed to figure out a way to make it work a whole lot better. We had that creative explosion. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the human fossil hunter people have long remarked, and this goes back 70 or 80 years probably, that the appearance of modern Homo sapiens in Europe, which is called Cro-Magnon type, appeared, you know, sometime before, you know, a creative explosion began to take place. And by creative explosion, I mean things like long-distance trading, a lot fancier design of tools, making fish hooks, things like that.
Well, that is where my possible hope comes from. We've just gone through a kind of creative explosion when we look at, you know, the iPhones and all the technology we've developed, but maybe we're not finished. Maybe under this extreme climate threat that's at our doorstep or actually happening, do we still have room in the brain to do even more?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's basically a matter of education rather than any. That is to say, we change the software by changing the childhood education. And so, yeah, I think we're capable of a lot more. But, you know, our problems don't really lie there. They lie in people being responsible to the community, you know, of seeing things that have to be done for the community's good and going out and doing them. And there's a fair number of people in various governments around the world that don't believe in that.
Right. Is there anything you'd like to add as we wrap up?
I'm more hopeful about the climate situation than I was maybe 5 years ago. And it's just in that meantime, I've looked more carefully at the issue of how do you take a lot of CO2 out of the air and do it quickly, in more or less the style that the ice ages did it, by growing a lot of additional plankton in the ocean and then sinking it into the ocean depths for long-term storage. You know, now that I look at that and see that it's technologically, economically possible to do something like that, I feel a lot better. I'm not sure it's going to get done, of course. There's not even the beginnings of projects along these lines. It's the whole biodiesel kind of movement. You can do on land, you can do in the oceans. But what I'm talking about is different from that. It's using just the indigenous algae whose components, the nutrients, have sunken into the deeper layers of the ocean. And if you pump them back up to the surface, you get a big bloom of algae. It seems to me that we have not done ourselves out of solutions yet.
We've been talking with Professor Calvin from the University of Washington. Find out more at williamcalvin.com. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Our website is ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening.